Sherry Simon, and Ms. Kipple. So would you like to use your time for rebuttal?
Yes, ma'am. I would like to ask for 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, sir.
Good morning, and may it please the court. On behalf of the appellant, Karen Von Zack, and my partner, Molly Garrett, I'm Keenan Goldfield, the law firm Sean Bach. For a case in which there was no trial, in which the record is relatively minimal, and the appendix, I would imagine, is much shorter than you would typically receive in a civil appeal, there are numerous procedural anomalies which make the posture of this case quite unique, certainly for a visitation case or a domestic relations case.
So let me ask you about the argument regarding the protective order, well, I call it protective order, the order of August 28th, is that it, 2015?
Yes, sir.
A couple questions. First of all, we haven't got the record of that procedure. We have no transcript. We have nothing. How do we know from the record that we do have that that protective order was ever dismissed by the court?
Your Honor, the language of the order speaks for itself, and the order dated August 28, 2015, I submit it is all that you need. The order.
Don't we have to have a record of that proceeding?
Your Honor, I don't think that you do, because again, this order comes into play in a couple of different places in this case, but first and fundamentally, we're asking that order be found void, and we're attacking it collaterally in a separate case. There was no record of that proceeding in the record of the case which has actually been appealed, so I don't think it would have been appropriate for me to include a record from another case as part of this appeal. But
you say you want to collaterally attack it, though, I'm seeing a couple of problems with that. First of all, the court clearly had jurisdiction to entertain the appeal of issuance of a protective order under 19.2, 152.10, right?
I would submit that at the time the appeal was noted, yes, sir.
So it had subject matter jurisdiction.
The circuit court had subject matter, albeit appellate de novo jurisdiction, yes.
Subject matter jurisdiction is the only jurisdiction that can be challenged collaterally. All other offices of jurisdiction have to be objected to a trial.
Correct.
We don't have any record to know whether you made any objection at trial to the authority jurisdiction of the court to enter the order.
Well, Your Honor, an objection as to the subject matter of jurisdiction in this instance was not necessary at trial. That the pleading which gave the court as a condition precedent jurisdiction, power, authority to enter any order in this case was the petition. And there is evidence in the record based upon what was filed in the motion to dismiss and for summary judgment, which shows how the petition was brought in the General District Court. That there was a hearing held pursuant to 19.2-1.
But you agreed to the issuance of that order. So you clearly did not object to the trial court's authority jurisdiction to do so, and thereby you waived any objection to the entry of that order.
Your Honor, the fact that the order was agreed to, the fact that the parties may have consented to the court having subject matter jurisdiction, is not dispositive on the issue of subject matter.
You just told me that the court did have subject matter jurisdiction. Under the applicable statute.
Up until the point that the petitioner withdrew her petition, which the face of the order clearly states that she did. Your Honor, if you look at the order dated August 28, 2015, it states at number one, petitioner Michelle Gregory withdraws her petition for a protective order. And Your Honor, I think from that point forward, the court's subject matter jurisdiction is extinguished. There's
you
no case.
Have authority to tell me that I can point to that says that once the court acquires jurisdiction, it somehow can be divested of that jurisdiction?
Your Honor, it's analogous to a non-suit. The withdrawal of the petition, there is case law cited in our brief which talks about the necessity of there being a pleading for the court to have any authority or jurisdiction to do anything.
But a non-suit doesn't affect the court's subject matter jurisdiction. It's the parties agreeing that at least for there's a temporary cessation of the court's exercise of that jurisdiction. Here we have the parties essentially present, we've settled this matter so the court doesn't have to take any further time with it. One of the benefits of the settlement for your client apparently was the nominal withdrawal of the petition given that put the matter before the court. I'm guessing that has all kinds of positive collateral benefits for her in terms of potential security clearances, jobs, things like that. The petition was withdrawn, therefore there is no actual finding. But it resolves the matter that the parties that was properly before the court and that the parties act in a manner that the parties themselves requested. That sounds like, as Judge Petty says, asking the court, that's not a challenge to its authority. That's the authority jurisdiction, not subject matter. The matter is within the confines of the circuit court.
I agree that the matter was within the confines of the circuit court once the appeal was brought. However, to use the non-suit analogy, because I think that's really what this is, if the court enters a non-suit and then as part of that non-suit order enters any additional terms that the parties may have agreed to, I would submit in that case, again, that the court does not have subject matter jurisdiction beyond entry of the non-suit.
How about if I enter a non-suit order more than 2 years after the cause of action accrued in a civil court, and by agreement of the parties say that statute of limitations is waived until for 8 months after the date of this instead of six? Under your theory, that second clause, once the non-suit order is it, once the first paragraph says non-suit, the parties' agreement on the extension of the statute of limitations would be of no consequence.
Your Honor, I'm not a tort lawyer, I'm a domestic relations lawyer, but I don't know what the effect of the parties having agreed to that extension would be. And yes, there are certain agreements within this order that may have become an issue if this case had ever gone to trial. But no, I do stand by the proposition that without that petition, once that petition is gone, the case is gone, and then there's nothing the court could do about it.
Let me come to the back end of this whole thing. The statute, 92-152-10, gives the court subject matter jurisdiction to enter an order prohibiting such contacts by the respondent to the petitioner or family or household members, etc. That's exactly what this order does. It prohibits contact. So why doesn't I just don't understand why the court doesn't have jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, to do exactly what the statute authorizes it to do?
Your Honor, it's analogous to if Ms. Garrett and I had a dispute and we wanted to enter an order limiting my contact with Ms. Garrett. But no case is filed. I am out on a Friday night. We find a circuit court judge or juvenile domestic relations court judge, general district court judge, who will sign our order, who will memorialize our agreement and make it a court order. There's no case pending. There's no jurisdiction for the judge to enter that order.
This order entered before or after the actual entry of the order terminating the appeal of the protective order?
I'm not sure I understand it.
Well, it was there a pending petition at the time the judge entered this order? Was that petition withdrawn at a later time? Do we know?
It was, again, the order speaks for itself, and it was withdrawn ostensibly prior to the order being signed because that's what the parties agreed to. That's what the order says. Or simultaneously. I don't think it makes a difference.
Well, it seems to me it has to be simultaneous because the first part, acknowledging that it's withdrawn, doesn't have any force. The paragraph you're relying on to divest the court of jurisdiction doesn't have any force in effect until the judge signs it. But of course, everything becomes effective when he or she signs it.
I agree. And what I'm saying, Judge Russell and Your Honors, is that the order can't do both. It either dismisses the petition or all of its elements are enforceable.
Well, didn't you ask the trial court to modify that order?
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
I mean, I'm getting into some pretty heavy approbate and reprobate. On one hand, you're asking for the order to be entered, and then you come in and ask for the order to be modified, and then you come before us and say, oh, but the order never was a valid order in the first instance.
Well, Your Honor, I'm certainly addressing these arguments in the alternative, and the alternative argument is that to the extent the court finds that that order is a valid order, is not a void order, then the order on its face calls for modification.
And that is approbate and reprobate. You can't ask the court to do something and then claim error when it does it.
I don't agree with that. I'm not taking an inconsistent position. I'm saying on the one hand, if it's void, but if the court finds that it's not void, then by its plain language, it called it.
Is it your client's request that the court enter the order, at least an implicit statement that you believe the court had jurisdiction at least at that moment? Otherwise you are just picking a judge up that you bumped into at the grocery store. I mean, you were before the court on this, the court was going to resolve it, and you said, we've resolved it in this fashion, please enter this order. You wouldn't ask a court that you didn't believe to have jurisdiction to enter an order unless you were in a pretty big game.
Your Honor, I was not counsel of record, I should note, at the time that this was entered, and respectfully, I would submit it doesn't matter.
Is it significant to you, counsel, that the part of this order does say, unless modified by court order?
It does for the issue that was brought up, that I believe Judge Petty brought up, that we did ask for modification, and the order states in two places, actually, that it's subject to modification, not only in the first line where it says that these terms are agreed to unless modified by
the court. And counsel, the record is at least a little complex. As I understand it, in the what I would call the protective order case, I think it's 15689.
Yes, sir.
You did file a motion to modify, or a motion to modify was filed by your client, scheduled to be heard a week after the dispositive motions hearing in the case that is not nominally, that has been appealed up to us.
Yes.
Did that hearing ever take place?
It did not.
Why not?
Because it was scheduled for the visitation trial. It was noticed for the visitation trial. At the hearing.
But it was recognized that it was in a different case. It was a separate case number. It was all of those things.
Well, the circuit court judge, I think from reading the transcript of the interchange between the two of us at that argument, wasn't clear that motion had actually been filed. I pointed that out to her, and she said, that's not before me now.
Right, because that's in the other case is how I read her comment.
I guess that's a fair reading of her comment. I'm not exactly sure what she said. She said it wasn't properly docketed. It's not before me now. There's nothing else before me now. I was just going to say,
you're into your rebuttal, and I want to give you a chance to answer Judge Russell's question, but I know you've got something else in the future in the rebuttal, so do you want to save the rest of your time for the rebuttal?
Please, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mariah Harani, appearing on behalf of Appley Mother Michelle Gregory. Before I reach the merits, I want to formally request that the appeal be dismissed, and the two bases for that are, of course, the absence of the record in which the protective order was entered. The court cannot adjudicate, and indeed the appellant cannot meet her burden to show clear error without the court having the benefit of that record.
Well, suppose I agree with you that the order is the court did have a jurisdiction to enter the order. I'll start with that proposition. Doesn't the order specifically say that it shall be modified by order of this court upon proper motion hearing?
It does say that, Your Honor.
And wasn't the motion to modify filed with the court? Circuit Court of Arlington County?
There was a motion set, but it wasn't set for a motion stay, and there was no basis given in that notice of motion for a modification. There's no independent basis that ever existed to modify the order.
But doesn't that become a matter for the court to determine on hearing? It seems to me that what you've done short-circuited the appellant's right to have a trial de novo on her request for a child visitation out of the appeal of the J&D court. I mean, the trial court could very easily have said, I'm going to modify this order consistent with my decision as to whether or not the child suffered harm. The appellant is a proper person to bring up to see a personal legitimate interest in the child. And you short-circuited that by arguing that the court shouldn't even address the motion to modify.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's in large part because those issues had already been adjudicated. There were issues of res judicata and estoppel that essentially made a trial at that point moot. We argued at the lower court the issue of standing, the issue of judicial estoppel due to the admission in that order, whether or not it's valid or void ab initio, an admission in that order of several things. One, the lack of legitimacy of interest that the appellant had because she ceded any interest in the kids to their mother, which showed that she couldn't have had any belief about the fitness of Mrs. Gregory's parenting. The second issue was that was in direct contravention to her position that the children were being actually harmed.
Let's take that first issue. I wrote this one, too. That was the very question before the circuit court on the appeal out of the J&D court, whether she's a person of legitimate interest, whether the child would be harmed by denial of visitation, or whether it's in the best interest of the child. And I agree with you. Those are mighty tall burdens to overcome, particularly by clear and convincing evidence. But isn't this person entitled by law to a hearing on that?
Your Honor, our position is those questions were essentially adjudicated, and she waived her rights.
Where?
In the parallel proceeding, in the protective order proceeding. And
how can an order that says on its face this consent order shall be modified by order of the court upon proper motion and hearing possibly be res judicata or collateral estoppel?
For several reasons. One, it's ceded to the mother care and custody of the children.
But by its nature, it's temporary. It's not final. It recognizes that the parties can come back and reopen this. I mean, I think that's Judge Petty's point. So how can you say that this issue has been resolved as between the parties for all time when the order itself says? Now, it may not should have happened in this case. Maybe it should have happened in a parallel case. But the order itself assumes that the parties have the power to come back and reopen the judgment. It is not a final judgment in that way.
No, but there was an adjudication of certain facts, and I think this gets into the other bases that were argued at the time of trial, and that was the judicial estoppel, that the appellant should have been stopped judicially from taking a contrary position than the one that she took in the matter that had been adjudicated, the protective order case, prior to the time the trial came about.
In the protective order case, did she ever assert that she wasn't a legitimate person under the statute to file an action?
Well, Your Honor, again, we don't have the record, and I also was not counsel of record in that case.
Well, based on what we have before us, it would be your burden to establish.
I think it's implicit in the admission that she made that she should have no contact with the children for a period of 18 months or until February of 2017, that her involvement in the care and the custody of the children was not required. And furthermore, that was in direct contravention, fully antithetical to her position that the children were being actually harmed by her absence.
Let me ask you this then. What do the words "unless modified by court order" mean? What legal significance do they have with regard to the other provisions of the order?
That suggests, I think, Your Honor, that the parties could modify the order by consent. But there was no basis in the order given for the court to modify otherwise in its plain language or its terms.
So your position is that it would be by a consent order?
Only, Your Honor, yes. And furthermore, there was no basis given at the time of the request of the modification for that arrangement to change. That was an agreement contracted for by both parties that there would be no contact between them until at least February of 2017. And further, she could have waited and brought her action later. But for that reason, I would ask the court to consider the issue of standing both upon the appeal and at the lower court, which is an independent basis to affirm, because here you have a litigant who, and these are all admitted facts, there's no dispute, she hasn't seen these children in now approaching 3 years. It had been over 2 years since she'd had any relationship with them. She agreed to no contact with them, notwithstanding the issue of actual harm.
If the facts are as compelling as you say they are, why didn't you just, you know, fight this on the facts? I mean, they have the burden of establishing by clear and convincing evidence all of the things that you're talking about. Why did this have to go out on this procedural issue rather than just address the substantive merits of the argument on appeal?
At that particular juncture in time, Your Honor, the case had culminated to a point where it was so compelling that there was absolutely no merit to proceeding. The appellant at that point had admitted that the pleading that she signed had absolutely no factual support. Discovery had just been concluded. There was no independent basis to think the case was anything other than frivolous. The passage of time had contributed to the issue of lack of standing at that point. And so to put appellee in a position where she was going to have to spend $25,000 to $30,000 on an additional trial that the appellant admitted had no basis in fact, and in light of the consent order that existed where she said, I agree to have no contact with these children, notwithstanding my belief that they're being actually harmed by my absence, it compels a motion to dismiss. And then, you know, the estoppel issues and everything else. So to usher in a 3-day trial and have to argue evidence in light of the totality of the circumstances was necessary. And I think this court can also make a finding that the appellee doesn't have standing here based on those facts and the records, including the fact that she non-suited her case once and waited a full 6 months before she revived it. Those facts, admissions, positions are wholly inconsistent with a claim that you have a legitimate interest.
Right. But that goes to the merits, and we don't have the merits in front of us. We just have the procedural.
Well, this is why I'm asking the court to assign that basis as another basis that the court was right to do what the court did in this particular case, because there's no dispute as to those facts. We know from the rule that
How can you say there's no dispute about those facts? I mean, I'm just guessing that your opponent here does dispute those facts.
Your Honor, I can tell you why. In the appellant's petition, she herself said, and that's a matter of record, that she hadn't had any relationship with the children since September of 2013. That's a fact that she admitted. It's clear in the record that she non-suited and waited 6 months to revive her suit. That's another thing that's beyond dispute. It's beyond dispute that it's a signed order. Ms. Bonsack put her own pen and ink to the paper that said, I agree to stay away from these children for a period of 18 months. That's also a fact that's not in dispute. So here you have a person who never had any legal relationship with the children, a de facto has no relationship with the children, has slept on her rights and essentially wants to go to trial on a claim that the children are being actually harmed by her absence. I think those facts are dispositive and are beyond dispute. And the court can certainly consider admissions in the record, statements
in
position.
All of those delays occasioned during the pendency of this proceeding or the various proceedings?
Yes.
So the fact that this lawsuit is going on is what caused her to not be able to have a relationship with the children. She had a relationship with the children for some period of time prior to the institution of proceeding, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, but she didn't pursue it anymore. And again, her saying, I agree to stay away from these children for a period of 18 months is not at all consistent with a person acting in loco parentis. You don't agree to stay away from your own children, which is her position, if they're being actually harmed. She didn't pursue that anymore. And the fact that she stopped pursuing
if the court had granted a motion for summary judgment based on that, you might have some argument. But if the court looked entirely to this one order and said, I can't even hear this. They screw up her hands instead of, and I wash my hands of it.
The court did allude, Your Honor, in making her ruling that she felt that those issues were intertwined, and she specifically mentioned the issue of standing. She just hung her hat on this particular issue, but that is, again, why I asked the court to assign that as an additional basis in which to affirm the lower court's ruling.
Turning to questions of jurisdiction and ignoring comity between judges on the same circuit bench, under the terms of the protective order, the judge in the custody case, as a judge of the Circuit Court of Arlington County, had the power to modify the order, correct?
I believe so. But I think, Your Honor, there is a question of noting that motion in the proper case, and also having a basis to modify it, because I continue to return to the fact that there was actually no basis in fact that was ever argued. There was no notice about any reason why that consent order, that agreement between the parties, could have and should have been modified. So I would ask the court again to consider assigning the additional reasons that militate towards affirmance in this case, and those are the standing issue, the issue of dismissal as a sanction, and estoppel. And finally, we would ask the court for an award of attorney's fees. Essentially, the corpus of this case revolves around a consent order, which the appellant now seeks to assail because it isn't consistent with her current position. And the frivolity of that position, I think, is further demonstrated by the fact that even if she were to prevail on the court that order was void ab initio, the result would be that the prior protective order would remain in full force and effect. And the prior protective order prohibited her from having any contact upon a merits hearing, and upon facts, from having contact with the children through March of 2017, which I also argue is a adjudication of the legitimacy of her interest. If a court of the Commonwealth determined that she was posing a threat or harm to the children that would cause her to be prohibited from any contact, that would be res judicata as to the issue of whether she had a legitimate interest as well as whether she had standing. But the fact that even if the appellant were to prevail on that argument, you'd end up in the same place. And, of course, she could have noted her motion to modify before taking this appeal, and any number of things demonstrate that there is an issue here with fees and unduly escalating the fees of mother, who is the sole caretaker here and who has been defending against this litigation for almost 3 years. For a litigant who doesn't seem to be all that concerned about time, considering she non-suited once before and agreed to 18 months of further estrangement with the children. So in conclusion, Your Honor, I ask that you affirm, assign the additional bases to support the court's conclusion, grant our request for attorney's fees.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. A number of things I'd like to respond to. First, one of the things counsel said toward the end was that to the extent the court were to find that the protective order was void ab initio, that would mean that the prior protective order from the general district court would remain in effect. I don't agree with that. If my client was the appellant, if she had withdrawn her appeal, statute 16.1, I don't have the exact site, talks about, then in that instance, the circuit court would re-enter the lower court order. If the case goes away at the circuit court level without a withdrawal of appeal, there's no order at all. That the circuit court is hearing the case de novo.
Could you address the attorney's argument that there are no facts in dispute here, or that the evidence is conclusive that the appellant is not a personal legitimate interest in the child?
Judge Petty and Judge Russell also brought out. There was no hearing on the merits. There has been no evidence received in this case.
Were there concessions on the part of the appellant that she had no interest in the child?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And in fact, if you look at the timing of the I'll call them the parallel cases, my client had refiled her petitions for visitation in the circuit court in, I believe, May of 2015. There was a protective order entered in the general district court, which was then appealed to the circuit court. That protective order was entered in the circuit court in August of 2015, at which time the trial was already scheduled on the visitation petitions. And that order, as has been pointed out, specifically stated it's subject to modification by a court, and it says it shall be modified, not maybe, but shall be modified upon proper motion and hearing. I don't know that I understand the argument that would require the consent of the parties.
Given your argument regarding the court's jurisdiction, assume you're right on that, and assume there's some sort of remand. If that occurs, with the fact that your client was willing to agree to an 18-month absence, that would be evidence the circuit court could consider regarding whether she was a person with a legitimate interest, whether there was a sufficient relationship, all of those things. You don't dispute that could play a role in the merits of attorney.
Judge Russell, don't dispute that. Acknowledge that in the brief. That and numerous other facts which would explain the relationship between the parties, why my client may not have had contact with the children. All of those are facts. All of those are fair game, along with the fact that what was agreed to in the circuit court, whether it's a void order or a valid order, was done with the explicit understanding that it would be subject to modification, and was done at a time when my client's petitions for visitation were pending and were scheduled for trial. I think it's also important to point out...
Your time is up, but I'm going to give you, if you want to take 30 seconds to wind up.
Just briefly, please. It's also important to point out the timing of the motion to dismiss and motion for summary judgment, that those were brought literally on the eve of trial. 5.5 months after this order in the parallel protective order case was entered, and despite the fact that the scheduling order that was entered in the visitation case required that dispositive hearings be brought as far in advance of trial as possible. I think that speaks volumes as to what the understanding regarding that order was. So Your Honors, I would ask that the court reverse the order of the circuit court, remand this case back to the circuit court for trial on my client's petitions for visitation, and earn an award of fees for this appeal in favor of my client, or remand that issue to the circuit court for determination of the right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come down.